You're listening to a Speech Therapy PD podcast. Earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode by completing the accompanying course online at speechtherapypd.com.
All right. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. My name's Corinne. I'm a speech language therapist. I work exclusively with Gestalt Language Processors. And if you're here, you probably want to learn more about them. You're interested in the autistic neurotype, how to help your autistic clients in bigger and better ways. And tonight's episode is about something that I need to learn more about, something I've been reading about, trying to dig deeper on, but I have to admit it's something that I don't feel quite confident with yet. And so I'm trying to have more conversations with clinicians who are interested in the motor system, who are doing their best to learn more about it too. And so I was excited to have my buddy Jesse on tonight. Jesse Musha, MSCCC SLP, is a pediatric SLP who works with ND populations in Chapel Hill, NC, and the surrounding areas. She graduated from Towson University, so right by me here in Baltimore, with her MS in 2014. She previously worked as an SLP in community-based settings, in public schools, clinical settings, with experience from 18 months all the way up to young adulthood. And Jesse also worked with people with and without disabilities, kids and adults in South America and Australia too, which I think is really cool. Jesse provides therapy services as well as consultative services and then trainings and education to other therapists, which I think is really great. This is someone we can keep learning from. So I want to invite on Jesse so we can get our conversation going about the motor system, autism, and how it relates to the clients that we work with. Hey, Jesse.
Hello. Thanks for having me. Good to see you.
Thanks so much for coming. I'm really looking forward to this because, again, as I said, this is an area that, oh my gosh, I need to know a lot more about this. And I'm betting that some people who are in our live audience who might be listening later, they're curious about the motor system too, and they might want to know which directions they can start their search about. So I read off your profile, but I want to hear more about how you got here.
How did I get here? Okay. I took a weird route in getting here. I went to undergrad and studied psychology. And then I was going to take this gap year to kind of figure out, like, you know, what exactly do I want to do before I, you know, bust into that master's level or PhD level study. And that was 7 years because that gap, man, that gap needed to happen. And that's when I spent some time traveling around, living other places, including South America and Australia, and really getting in and working with some of the populations that I aim to serve in my career. And that's truly where I learned the most about what I wanted to do and what I still had yet to understand about supporting kids in particular. And that wild 7-year journey led me to finally going back to get my master's at Towson and turn the tables a bit and go into the field of speech language pathology. So it all worked out. It just took me a little longer to get there. So if any of you budding SLPs out there thinking about taking that gap year before you launch into it, I highly recommend it. Absolutely. We don't do that in the US. We should do that gap year thing.
I know. I feel like I'm craving it now. I'm like, I need my gap year now.
You should do it. I'm gonna be on you about that in the DMs later.
I'm thinking about it. Okay. So when we think about so many people, when I have them on podcasts, we're like, how did you get to the point of being really invested in the GLP framework, learning about this profile and working with these kids who kind of, you know, fit into all those characteristics that describe a GLP. But I'd also love to hear more about how you've started to get really interested in and excited about clients with significant motor differences. So what's that?
So you have to go back to daycare, where I made my first autistic friend. And I guess somebody at that time, this was like in the early 80s, had the language about GLP. It just wasn't mainstream like it is now. And it's still not even completely mainstream, right? But one of my first friends was a kid at daycare who primarily communicated through scripts. And his special interest was Jeopardy. And so he would like set up all these cardboard bricks. Do you know the big cardboard bricks that they have at daycare? Do they still have those?
I had those as a kid and I missed them.
Yeah, they're amazing, right? And they're easy and they're cheap. Anyway, he would build podiums out of them. And then, you know, he'd set it all up. I vaguely knew what Jeopardy was, but I didn't fully understand exactly what we were doing, but I knew that it was really interesting and it wasn't like what anybody else was doing. And I was fully invested in being the participant, and he would be Alex Trebek and then he would tell me what to say. And I had no idea what I was talking about, but I was like, this is really interesting and fun. And he would script entire movies. And I remember walking next to him. We would walk from this daycare center down through the neighborhood and go to the pool in the summer. And I would just walk next to him and I felt like I was watching a movie through his eyes. And this is like very early core memory stuff. And I think ever since then, I've been fascinated by autism and autistic people, and have just enjoyed their company as well. And so I was like, what a cool thing to be able to go into a career where I support and love and care for and work alongside autistic kids, you know. And because although this friend was an incredibly cool friend and I really enjoyed playing with him and being with him, I also saw him have some really scary and painful meltdowns. And I remember that just as well as I remember our time together playing.
Yeah. So all of this started really early for you. I love the way you describe kind of like that play gestalt of recreating what I call like the tableau. Like you set up the scene, the tableau, and then you can enter into it and kind of be part of that world. It's fantastic. I once
so
had
you
a
know that like as adult therapists supporting this population, you have to like seamlessly like go into that play and be like, yep, I don't know what we're doing, but I'm here. And I'm like, let's go into it. Right.
I
did
tell
that as a kid and I didn't even know what I was doing.
I tell people all the time, I'm like, they're like, how do you get good at working with GLPs? I'm like, you have to be theatrical. It's improv.
Yep.
I don't know what scene my client's going to recreate that day. I had one client where I was like, it's going to be the zoo today. I'm ready. It was Hickory Dickory Dock. He built a clock out of nugget pillows. And then we had to be the animals going up and down. So it's so improvisational. It's like, okay, what is happening right in front of me? And then how can I jump in and join in?
And be in 100% from the moment you jump in, right?
That's right?
What it's all about.
The idea of like commit to the bit, but it's like truly, what do they call it? Like method acting? Like
it is, that's what it is. We're actors. Oh my God, we really are. Yeah. But I learned how to do that early on, which I don't think I've ever made this connection before until now. Thank you for this. But yeah, I'm like, that's how I learned to be a really good play partner.
Yeah.
Especially to GLPs, was at that time.
Yeah, the idea of being exactly like that play partner and being remarkably present, like in the present moment, it's extremely hard for adults. It's extremely hard for adults who are on the job too. And it requires so much vulnerability to not know what's coming next. And also to be kind of like maybe in a state of confusion about what a kid is trying to show you or act out to you. You have to let go of a little bit of control there when you're in play. Play is the suspension of self. It's, I don't know. I love that. I know a lot of people can feel really uncomfortable with that.
I think that it's really a fun way for us to get uncomfortable and to be vulnerable and reclaim our childhood in a small way. I feel so much joy doing this work. So I have no problem letting go of it.
Yeah.
But I have to answer the second part of your question, which is about how did I get interested in complex motor systems?
Yeah.
I think that came along a little bit later, but still prior to becoming an SLP. When I worked in Australia, I worked at a day program for adults. And I was a support worker. You know, it was one of the many jobs that I held while I was in Sydney. Sydney's a very expensive city. You have to have a couple of jobs. But this was my favorite job. And it was like, it was everything. It was the whole reason I became an SLP. And one of the community members that I spent a lot of my time with was completely non-speaking and lived in a complex body due to cerebral palsy. And we had such an incredibly deep and amazing relationship. And he had no way to communicate with me through AAC, no way to reliably and consistently and fully communicate with me, but our communication was still deep and meaningful, and the relationship was able to form sort of in lieu of this true, you know, AAC or true deep communication ability. And to the point where when I left for the last day, when I had to leave the country and come back, we both just looked at each other and cried before I left. Like it, there was such a deep connection between us. And I left Australia knowing, like, I know what I'm going back to do. I'm going back to figure out how I can get to grad school and become a speech therapist. This is absolutely what I want to do. So that was the beginning of that, is really seeing how much he was able to do with so little motor capacity, to be honest, and just truly seeing how much language was inside of him despite not having that outlet. Yeah. And I wanted him to have one very badly. So I sort of committed myself to the rest of this journey here. And I'm on the journey. I don't know everything. I have some answers, not many. Those answers might be wrong. Next year I might have a different answer, but I'm very much on the journey and committed to it.
Yeah, I think we were talking about what this podcast can look like in that it's very conversational. And when I interview people, we're talking about their clinical experiences, positioning the information that they've learned, what they've pulled from research, as well as pulled from, you know, clinical longitudinal information, clinical opinion. So we can have the conversations where all of you who are listening, you can pull out the things that feel meaningful and relevant to you. We give you search terms to take with you. You might hear your clients or your child in these conversations. But yeah, we're not pretending that like we are the leading experts or researchers on these topics. We like to give ideas for what has worked for us and hope that you can take it with you and try it out tomorrow. So when we're thinking about an autistic individual, you know, with a complex motor system, complex communication, think about, well, you know, I was just reading about how like motor differences or complex motor presentation isn't part of, you know, diagnosis. But the percentage of autistic people who present with motor differences is pretty significant. Can you tell me more about when you think about like common co-occurring conditions or some of the overlapping profiles we see in autistic clients?
Yeah. So I did pull some research a while back to put together a post about some of the more common co-occurring conditions that many of us don't really know about or might be overlooked, especially when we're talking about autistic kids and teens, and kind of pulled together some research. And then what I like to do, and this is, you know, for social media, but I still think that when we're posting and content creating on social media, we have a responsibility to the public, especially if we're a public-facing account, to do our due diligence and make sure that what we're presenting is accurate. So what I do when I put together a post of this significance is I have that post peer-reviewed. So this actually comes from a post I put up back in May on my social media account that was then peer reviewed by a friend of mine who is incredible when it comes to research. So I feel pretty good about these stats. So apraxia, I kind of lump these ones together. This comes into like the complex, you know, motor system thing, apraxia, dyspraxia / developmental coordination disorder. Estimates suggest that between 30 to 50% of autistic individuals have some form of apraxia or motor planning difficulties, which is, I think, when you think about that statistic and back what we learned when we were in grad school about the prevalence of apraxia, that's shocking, right? We were told apraxia is relatively rare. You're probably almost never going to see it, right? And I think a piece of that is because it's so underdiagnosed.
Yes. I still remember.
What do you want to say?
I still remember, and I have a terrible memory when it comes to like, I have a really bad spatial memory, but I remember sitting in my lecture and the professor, so much detail about all the other, you know, motor speech profiles. And it was kind of like the scene in Mean Girls where like, and none for Gretchen Wieners, bye. It was like, and there's CAS, but it's super rare. Click. And yep. I just remember sitting there and being
That's
like,
it.
I think I might want to know about this.
Yeah, right. And when we talk about apraxia, when we're talking about speech therapists, we're often thinking about CAS, right? Apraxia of you know, oral apraxia, apraxia of speech, childhood apraxia of speech. And not to say that that's not a piece here, but really when we're seeing that in autistic clients, often what we're seeing is that it's resulting in either minimally speaking, unreliably speaking, or a non-speaking status. But how often do you see that we're actually giving that apraxia diagnosis alongside whatever else is on our, you know, report? We're often not doing it, usually because we're not giving a standardized assessment for that. But that doesn't mean that we can't use clinical observation and our clinical lens to give a suspected apraxia of speech diagnosis alongside whatever else it is that we're putting on that report. I think that it's something that needs to be considered more thoroughly, because I think it better helps others understand what is truly causing the non-speaking status in a lot of autistics. It's not a lack of understanding or language very often. It is most often a motor challenge, getting the message from the brain down to the mouth. So I think that stat is like really, really important to look at. And then in addition to that, an estimated 50 to 80% of autistic individuals have developmental coordination disorder, which is, you know, they kind of, we kind of lump those all together, even though there are some differences between them. And that's pretty significant. I mean, we do see that a lot of our clients are often have OT, PT services in addition to speech. But I think there is a lot that is overlooked when it comes to the motor challenges that are sort of inherent in the autistic neurotype for many, many individuals.
Yeah, we think about, there's this phrase I heard from a PT I worked with back in. I see a lot of people in the chat are talking about early intervention. I started in early intervention. I love EI. There was an EI PT I was working with, and we kept having, when we had the same client, that child would have some sort of gross motor burst with postural stability. Mm-hmm. She would come knock on my door and be like, talk to me next week when their language bursts. And it would happen a lot. And there was this phrase of like, from stability comes mobility, that she would say. Because on that team, I was so lucky, we were considering the motor system as kind of like the starting point of when spoken language could start to take off too. Not that it doesn't happen with people with, you know, more complex bodies, but it was a really interesting relationship there between gross motor and expressive speech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Do you want to talk about some of the other co-occurring conditions before we like go a little deeper on motor in particular?
I'm so ready with a citation I want to talk about okay. Motor versus praxis, but let's do the other ones first.
Okay. Well, just, I mean, brief, just because I think they're worth mentioning. I'm not going to go into like all the stats on all of them, but a couple of the other ones that I thought were very important for people to better understand are things like POTS, EDS and HSD, right? Hypermobility spectrum disorders, OCD is another one that we very often see in our non-speaking clients.
Yes. I need to learn more about that, because it's a lot of my kids right now. We're seeing it.
Yeah. And it's not something that we are prepared clinically or professionally to really support. And how many of your clients that you're seeing OCD in are actually working with, you know, a really well-versed psychologist or mental health professional that are supporting that, right?
Right. And it's thinking about like, what are restricted repetitive behaviors and what is perseveration, right? What are the thought loops?
Right.
It's parsing all that out, where I'm just like, I don't know, because I don't know much about OCD. And then also thinking about, I've had conversations with parents when I'm encouraging them to look into it. I'm like, I want to make sure my intervention is not making this worse or harder, the way I'm interacting with them. And I wonder sometimes.
Yeah, same, very much same. And just making sure that I'm there to support as best as I can, even when things are starting to fall outside of my scope. Right. Those are probably the top ones, to be honest. So yeah, let's hear this citation.
Okay. So as I was preparing for the episode, I was really looking into, I mean, the first place I was looking, because this is an area of interest for me, is structural differences in the autistic brain. I think that that really, that interest started because I was encountering a lot of well-meaning people who are like, oh, they're just being stubborn. Oh, they don't want to talk, all that. And I was like, boom, here are all the structural reasons inside of your child's brain. We're like, that is not, like, the cytoarchitecture of this child's brain is different. But I was looking into, I found a paper, and I know, guys, don't worry. I'm going to put that citation right in that chat for you. Oh yeah, someone else said they're being naughty. Mm-hmm. And then for girls, they're just shy. Anyway.
Yeah, okay, can we just say for the record too, that not wanting to communicate is not a thing. It's just not a thing.
It's, yeah, sharing information with other people is.
Yeah, everybody wants to communicate. Everybody wants to connect. Not being motivated to communicate is just not a thing. I won't acknowledge that as being even remotely valid.
And it's just such like a, almost like, not like a thought terminating cliche, but it just feels like end of conversation of they're
Where do you go from there?
Right, exactly. Really? Okay, so this paper is from 2022. I tried to pull things from like 2021 and recent from that, and there's a lot. So it's called Motor Performance, Praxis, and Social Skills in Autism Spectrum Disorder and Developmental Coordination Disorder. So this was interesting because I had never considered, because it's just something I hadn't thought about, how to think about motor versus praxis. I had never considered them to be conceptualized differently. And so this paper kind of parses those two out in an interesting way. So motor performance skills by these authors, so motor, they talked about these as controlled and goal-directed actions for things like fine motor of the hands, ball play, balancing, and those skills are reliant upon frequency, speed, direction, kind of those like measurable dynamics. But they talked about praxis as representational or non-representational imitation and gesture production. So actions that represent something else. I apologize if anyone can hear my dog barking in the background. He is communicating very loudly right now.
He's excited about it. It's a good talk, you know?
He loves this stuff. But yeah, motor is like the goal directed that you can like measure through speed, through distance, but not, it doesn't necessarily represent something else. It's not necessarily like a symbol for something else. But praxis is being able to like capture a concept that is sharing a message with someone else. At least that's what I'm pulling from it. They were talking about praxis can be a way to like measures kind of like social communicative exchange too. So those were some of the ideas I pulled from that. What do you think about that?
I think that's fascinating. I was thinking you were going to go in one direction with it. It didn't go in the direction I thought. But I was sort of thinking about the difference between intentional versus rote motor. And, I think that is a concept that's really, really interesting and why so many non-speakers get missed when it comes to having some sort of motor diagnosis or really recognizing that they have a complex and unreliable motor system. Okay.
Yeah.
So when you really start getting into the weeds, talking to like some people that really understand this stuff, in particular, there's some OTs out there who really understand this stuff. They will get to talking all about overmyelinated like neural pathways. And those represent the rote motor tasks that we could, it's the stuff we can do in our sleep without even thinking. But it can also represent in a complex motor system, unintentional motor that the individual doesn't actually want to be doing, but is doing because it is a rote and routined, over-practiced motor pathway versus intentional motor of doing something that kind of goes through the brain, through the ideation, through the motor cortex, and that you're doing really novelly, spontaneously, and intentionally. Those are very different motor systems, different motor pathways. And that second piece is the part that could be really, really challenging with somebody with a complex body.
That word ideation, that was a new one for me for like the past year. It has really shifted how I've thought about thinking, right? And thought about how bodies move. that might be a word that is unfamiliar to other speech therapists or people listening. Tell us more about what that word means to you.
To me, that means just like coming up with an idea of exactly what you want to do and yep. then executing the motor, yeah. right? I think that that's like, to really simplify it. I think that this is what is often breaking down when we talk about those with complex bodies. And sometimes you'll also hear people refer to it as the brain-body disconnect. Okay. Is really having that intentional thought of exactly what you want to say, do, how you want to respond, and actually then being able to execute it and have that happen and come through the body. That when, and a lot of this that I'm pulling on right now is stuff that I have learned. I'm really like getting into the weeds right now. Like we went deep into it really fast. A lot of what I have learned in this area and where a lot of things I'm saying are coming from is the things that I've learned through listening to the non-speaking community.
Okay.
So those non-speakers who are usually adults, but sometimes teens, that have found consistent, reliable manners of communicating have gone on to share their experience of living in sometimes what is also described as a, how do they explain it? An uncooperative body. Okay. This is a lot of times the language that is used in this population. And so listening to that experience, I think is so much more valuable than anything we can get from a research lab or a research paper, right? Because all we can do is observe what we see. They're living in it. Right? Mm-hmm. They're living it every single day. They're the one that can say, I had an idea of what I wanted to do, but that's not what my body did. My body did the opposite. Like, that's really frustrating. Like, this is the experience that many non-speaking autistic adults are having with uncooperative bodies, bodies that have that brain-body disconnect, or we can use any of the other motor labels that we've thrown out thus far, right?
Yeah. Lisa just asked a great question in the chat of example of uncooperative body.
Let me give an example.
I read one while you're thinking. I read one about there was a child who loved surfing, but he sometimes would, and I wish I could remember where I could find it so I could reference the poster. He would like not want to put on his wetsuit and he would like run away from the water. But then when he was surfing, it was like he was free. He was so happy. He was overjoyed. But it was like his body kept, like, it wasn't cooperating with that idea of his favorite activity.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great example, right? Really the only way that we know for sure that what we're seeing is an uncooperative body, a brain and a body that are disconnected, and the ideation, what the individual wants to do and the message they're sending to the body is getting scrambled or is not happening or whatever the outcome is. The only way we know that for sure is when an individual has consistent, reliable communication and can communicate that. Otherwise, we're only relying on what we observe. We're making our best guess. Even the most knowledgeable in this area, unless an individual tells you that's their experience, we're making a guess, right? I think that's really important. We don't have a way to really study that at this point. The only thing we do have is the communication of those who are living in these bodies, right? But right, it's you know, wanting to, you know, go for a walk and then not being able to stand up from your chair, you know, is a very simple example.
Yeah. I just saw an interesting question from Lynn, thank you, about choreic movements, like chorea, Chorea. Is that an example of an uncooperative body? And so when it comes to that, big answer, I don't know, because that's an area I don't know much about, but I did quickly look into like, what is the cause of that choreic movement, which is associated with, it looks like Huntington's disease, Parkinson's. And I looked at cause of that. Let me tell you what it is first. It's kind of like a writhing movement, like uncontrollable writhing movement. And anyone who's listening knows more about it. Like, please start screaming if I'm wrong. But they're talking about its differences in the basal ganglia, dopamine regulation in the basal ganglia, which the autistic brain does have a lot of basal ganglia differences. And so that's the overlap that I know about between the two. I can't say anything else about whether they're related or not. But yeah, dopamine, basal ganglia, maybe. I think that's a really interesting thing. If anyone wants to do some digging about that after and let us know.
Can we speak to Olivia's question too? I think that's an interesting one.
Oh yeah, read it out. Let's hear it.
Okay. Kind of reminds me of the idea of when some people with ADHD become frozen. Hi, ADHDer, often frozen over here, and can't do what they want to do when they become overwhelmed. I sit in that state usually when I have several things on my list. And I know which one's the priority, but there's a more fun one somewhere down the list. That's when I often get frozen. I do wonder if there are some underpinnings of those things that may be similar, but I think overwhelmingly they can be fairly different from the ways that I've had it explained to me from the non-speaking community. Even though I experienced some level of like being frozen in a state of overwhelm, I think that it does have some pretty large differences, but one of the similarities maybe is that I can often verbally coach myself out of that state. After some time, I usually give myself a little bit of time to be frozen. Never hurt anybody have a little frozen time. And then I will verbally coach myself out of the state. Interestingly, on that note, one of the only interventions I think that we currently know of, and I don't even know if there's any research on this, Corinne, so good luck to you, but that is
I'm gonna look.
please do. An intervention that is used by OTs that are knowledgeable in this area, and now some other therapists, including myself, who are beginning to become more knowledgeable in this area. And back to your point about experts, I never call myself an expert in anything. I'll never ever use the E word. I will only use the word enthusiast. I'm very enthusiastic about this. I'm enthusiastic about GLPs. I'm enthusiastic about non-speakers. I'm enthusiastic about motor. So I want to learn everything I can about it, but I'm definitely no expert. But motor coaching is the thing. We learn as SLPs how to coach the motor of the mouth. We don't learn about coaching the motor of the body, and we need to, because when we're talking about a non-speaker who is potentially very unlikely to gain full and reliable mouthward communication, we need to be thinking about how we can coach the motor of their body for that communication. Because if you're using an AAC device, for example, your body is the instrument now, right, to make the communication happen, not your mouth. So that same motor coaching that we do here, we need to be able to do here to help support the body in making the movements, intentional movements that it needs in order to effectively communicate. So yeah, tell me what you come up with on a good old motor coaching here.
Is that that's the main phrase they use to refer to it?
I mean, it might have a more clinical term, but that's all I've ever heard it called is motor coaching.
Okay. If that's the term for it, I found something with kids with CP about like retention and transfer of gross motor function. I don't know if it's a good study because I'm just looking at it now. Luckily I'm a speed reader. I got to read this in more detail. But yep, they're saying that there are benefits, but I need to look at like the methods and things like
so
that.
I could kind of give you guys a little bit of the, I don't know, where my brain's at when I'm doing it and kind of how I do it as well as a beginner learning how to do this and work in collaboration with my clients, right? Yeah. To do this. So when I think about physical or motor supports for complex motor systems, right? You know, I am definitely on the same train with most SLPs where, you know, doing hand over hand is not effective for a variety of reasons, right? You know, of course, it violates body autonomy, so I don't like it for that reason. We also don't want to put words in an individual's mouth because only they know what they want to say. And I also like think about like, and I'm not a motor person, so maybe this is a stupid example, but it makes sense in my brain, so I'm going to say it out loud. I think about like, I'm going to the gym and I like hire a personal trainer because I want to get like really fit, right? They're not going to put a weight in my arm and then just move my arm for me, because I'm not building muscle when somebody is doing the active work and my muscle is passive, right? I'm not going to learn anything from that. I'm not going to build anything from that. What a good physical trainer is going to do is they're going to maybe put their hand back here. They're not going to touch me. They're going to like almost touch me, but not touch me. And they're going to go, good, 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 good. Keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going. Yep, yep, keep it up. They're going to keep like encouraging and verbally coaching the motor, what my body's supposed to do to move through that movement that is a new motor movement for my body. And that's how I think about motor coaching is that we're not doing for. We're not going to be driving the motor and they are going to be passive and somehow that's going to translate to learning. No, it is literally coaching the body through visual and verbal cues that really break down the motor into very specific and tiny steps. And when you actually start doing this and start thinking about all the steps, for example, what do you have to do to stand up? Like, I don't think about that. I just stand up, right? But when you start thinking about what your body has to do to actually engage muscle groups in each part of the body to stand up, there's about 18 different steps, right? So when you start coaching in this way and providing those broken down verbal cues to non-speakers, you really start to understand, first of all, what is the struggle, right? The struggle is real. There's a lot of motor involved. And then you can get really, really good at breaking that down to really support an individual in moving through those movements to do what they want with their body. It takes a really, really strong and deep connected relationship built on mutual trust and understanding and empathy to do this work with an individual. You can't just come in cold and start doing this with somebody. You have to really be able to see when an individual wants to be able to follow through with motor or when they don't and be able to say, ah, let's just drop it. It seems like maybe you don't want to do this right now. So it's something that I'm very much learning a lot about and very much relying on my clients to guide the way when it comes to how can I better support the motor of their bodies?
Yeah. Yeah. I think about how I've shifted, how I think about it. Like I was in that kind of, I'm really trying to heal my black and white thinking and my all or nothing thinking. And the idea of like, never do it. Like any sort of that level of support. And then there's so much in the middle of what every kid's body benefits from and how they react to it. I have some clients that I've worked with where they really enjoy that process of working together physically to make gains like that. There is that higher level of connection. And I think about so much when I watch OTs and PTs at work, there's so much physical contact to make changes happen with that kid. I know it's different when it's about like transmitting messages and communication, but that all or nothing of like, never, ever do anything like that. I wonder how much is that holding back progress, like the motor system through us.
I saw somebody asked about hand under hand.
Yes.
And I wanted to acknowledge that because I have clients who take my hand, quite literally will take my hand. And I think that really what that provides a lot of the time is the proprioceptive feedback they need to move through the motor. Like they need to have some weight. And so look, if that's my client, not only consenting to that touch, but requesting that touch. Mm-hmm. And so usually what happens when they take my hand is they say, you know, I'll say, do you want to use my finger? Or do you want to use your finger? I'm going to go passive, but you just do what you want to do. Like I'll tell them you're driving. Like, I don't know what, especially when it comes to like the AAC device, you know, I'll tell them, I don't know what you want to say. You're driving, but you're welcome to hold my hand if that's helpful. So I absolutely have clients who will initiate that. So in that case, they already know what they need and they're initiating that. Right. And so that's absolutely okay with me. There may be situations where I have had a client who has done that in the past and it has proven to be helpful for them. And if I see that they're struggling, I might offer my hand and say, you know, you're welcome to jump on if you want. Is that what I may like offer it as, you know, here you go. Here's the support if you want it. Right. I'll also have these clients. You probably have these clients, you guys, who will put their elbow, they'll dig their elbow into you.
I was just going to say that.
Right? They're finding a hinge because now you only have to move this part of your arm. You don't have to, I'm like moving my arm around wildly. These poor people on the podcast are going to be like, what is this lady talking about? I'm trying to show everybody in the chat, but you know, they now only have to move a particular portion of their body, not completely from the shoulder, maybe even the core through the shoulder all the way through, because they found a good way to hinge their body. So I'm always paying attention to that with my complex motor system kids and teens, because then I can go, aha, that seems like a thing that you're already seeking out that you know helps you. How else can I provide that? Where can we find a good tabletop that's at the right height, or piece of furniture or something that you can easily hinge your arm on? Or can I help show you how to hinge your arm on the side of the table, or, you know, playing around with angles and positioning and all of this stuff, because they clearly are trying to show you this is what works for my body. So we need to be paying attention and leaning into that and finding other ways of supporting that.
Yeah. I was just thinking about the clients who like position themselves in our laps against us leaning, and noticing some of those kids, that is when they're most successful with their device. That is when they're most successful with producing expressive speech or using like a letter board or anything like that. It's when there are very interesting stabilizing positioning choices, or like getting the proprioceptive input or vestibular input that they're looking for. Like, I love the idea of like kind of step back and think about, where is this client most successful? What is their body doing? How are they leveraging gravity, touch, compression? And then like, what are the elements of that we can bring into other communicative settings and experiences?
There's also this beautiful co-regulation aspect to the way that you're describing, like your client, like leaning into you, and there's
the
like this connection and safeness, and right. Like when you're the communication partner, when you can provide that co-regulation and that safety, of course, that's going to be a component in supporting their best self and their best communication.
Yeah. But it's like, it's so much more than just here, right? It's so much more than like the neck up. It's what's going on the rest of them. And how does that contribute to what they're able to communicate about? I'm looking in, someone just got very excited about co-regulation in the chat. Yeah, that felt safety. That idea of felt safety is so big when I think about kids with a PDA profile as well, that neuroception too, and how they can experience that with us. I want to go back a little bit. We have a lot of questions. Jess, you've got people excited. I can tell. This is the most active chat I have ever had. I love it. A lot of people have been saying that they're in early intervention or preschoolers, and thinking about how can we work on some of these things early on? What are some of the ways we can interact with these kids to help them with coordination, with praxis, with their motor system being able to more effectively communicate with itself and with the brain? Do you have any ideas just throw out about activities and experiences?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, and I think somebody said this long ago in the chat, is obviously like, please, like, collaborate with your local OT and PT, especially if you are lucky enough to have one on that child's team already. Oh my gosh, like, make them your best friends, invite them to the potluck, like, make sure that you guys are on it together. I have learned so much from my OT and PT counterparts and colleagues. That's been some of the most important work of my career, is working alongside those very amazing motor-minded folks. And then, you know, but sadly there are times when you are the only one on that team, and there really isn't anyone else with a motor background, and we have to get really creative in how we support those with complex bodies. And there are quite a few things that I just sprinkle into my sessions that are really supportive. One is really, really easy, but also depends on the environment that you're in. I have a 7-year-old non-speaker, let's call him minimally speaking, definitely GLP, with a complex body. We start the majority of our speech therapy sessions by going on a hike. We will, like, quite literally go on a hike, which gives him so much proprioceptive input to his body. You're like doing this deep, you know, work of walking and trudging through the woods. And, you know, we're getting like our diaphragm moving, and we're moving our bodies, we're breathing deeply. And then there's all the regulation of like being out in nature. And then we come back into the clinic, and then we're ready for speech, because we've sort of like warmed up the body from head to toe. And then we'll come back in and do that. And this kid, it now initiates these hikes. He's like, this is how we start. This is the way we got to do it. If you're working in a clinical setting or a school setting and you're lucky enough to have any say over how your schedule looks, I love if OT or PT goes first and like their session backs up to speech. I always find that my kids are much more ready to get into the speech or communication element of therapy after they've just done quite a lot of physical activity with their OT or PT.
I've also been hearing about like collaborating with them and yeah, thinking about timing and sequencing. Been hearing about people looking more into other physical modalities that give a lot of input, like horseback riding, hippotherapy, and all of these are so contingent upon resources and time. And I want to just say that from the jump. Swimming lessons too.
Being in the water in general.
Think about all that light compression, all that vestibular information, also safety, right? Swimming lessons for autistic kids. That's a huge way to help promote safety. But I'm thinking about, you know, like anecdotes about some of the GLP clients I work with where they have come out with like the best gestalt in the water and loud too, like really, really loud. So we're thinking about if how, you know, if that's a successful experience, a successful set of conditions for communicating, why and can we replicate that in other places? So yeah, horseback riding, swimming. And then of course, the one I got to bring up is being in motion with music. The power of rhythm to act as, there's a phrase called a forcing function. Rhythm kind of helps chop up the passage of time. And hearing a steady rhythm can help the body move in a steady rhythm, which then helps with like noticing one's body and what it's doing and getting good information and monitoring it. And so I say like really, really valuing the importance of early music experiences. For those of you who are saying EI for preschool students, yes, if they have a music class, I mean, there's less and less of that, right? But having a music class, super important. But what are they doing in the music class? Is there coordinated group movement? Are there opportunities for this child to witness other kids' bodies in motion, to do that imitation? And are they getting up and moving too in this music class, not just sitting in a circle doing small motions? If you're not seeing that whole body involvement in the music classes they're in, could you coordinate and work with or collaborate with the music teacher? We often talk about OT, PT in like school settings or in clinic settings, but what if a music teacher is going to be a really good resource and just little modifications to their curriculum can make a big difference?
What if they could sprinkle in some motor coaching?
Amazing. Just sprinkle it a little bit. But yeah, the mathematics behind music really do a lot of powerful things for the rhythms of the body, even down to like the oscillations and the way that information is cycling in the brain. I mean, steady rhythms are, that is my go-to when I'm starting out with a kid with a more complex body or a non-speaking GLP is let's get more rhythmicity into their life outside of them. So then the rhythms within them can start to become more regular. I noticed there's one person who mentioned wanting to potentially collaborate with the PE teacher in a school. And then someone else said that they had successfully done that. So I think that's a really cool idea. I've never thought about like collaborating with a gym teacher before. It makes perfect sense. That makes me want to think about, I don't have any great answers right now, but the kind of activities that could happen in a school setting that is all about physicality that could be helpful. Anything come to mind for you, Jesse, or anyone in the chat?
Can you say that question one more time? Because I was reading the chat.
I make long sentences. I want to truncate what I say more. Think about a PE setting for kids, collaborating with a gym teacher. Any activities come to mind?
Literally anything that you would do in PE but thinking about how you can bring that motor coaching support into it. Like, for example, if a child, and I saw APE, right, adapted physical education, but really this could be for, you know, your gen ed PE as well, is if a child is not doing, you know, an activity that you are expecting them to do, maybe consider that maybe it's not that they won't, but that they can't. And just try giving some of that motor coaching support and see how it goes, you know, experiment with it and see how that might contribute to success. Because I think if you're doing that in gross motor work, that's really good data about how that could potentially support an individual when it comes to communication or other areas.
Yeah,
I think it would be good for all of us to be taking data on how those motor coaching supports do or don't support learning new movements. I saw another question too. You had something else to say. Go ahead.
It's in there. Give me a second. I'm like jumping back along the chain. Oh my gosh, I'm so close. It's right there. It's gone. It might go back. Whatever. It might be gone. Are you talking about Jennifer's question?
Yeah. And Jennifer, I'll read this question out loud. Love the motor coaching concept to support students. I'm now wondering if unexpected physical behaviors that I'm seeing in class or on the playground, like throwing objects, pushing other students, clearing a table for toys, pulling down pictures off a wall, etc., relate to the GLP's lack of motor coordination, maybe a cause and expect experiment, ? And I think like those are all really good questions, but it made me think of a concept that I haven't yet brought up, which is something called motor loops.
Have you
read about that at all?
I've heard about it and I see it.
Yep, motor loops. And I just off the bat, before I even say what it is, it's really challenging to know for sure if an individual is experiencing a motor loop, which is an unintended motor action, like we were talking about before. It's just sort of different language for what we've already kind of covered. Is this an unintentional motor action that their body is doing without their consent? Or is it something like they're throwing things because they're doing some trajectory play, which is a type of play, by the way, you know, it can be really, really challenging to know the difference. But I do have a post, this is from March of this year, all about motor loops that I did in collaboration with an OT based in LA, somewhere in California, who primarily works with non-speakers and is incredibly knowledgeable on this topic. And I've learned a lot from her. Her Instagram tag is sunrise.therapies. If you want to follow her, name's Erin. Really have learned a lot from her. But I think that this concept and understanding motor loops and potentially how to recognize them when you see them, and then how to support an individual if they are in an unwanted motor loop and want to come out, because motor loops... This is just another confusing piece of it. They can sometimes look like stims, and it can be really hard to know are we having a fun regulation stim, or is this a really like unintentional motor loopy stim and you would rather not be doing it, right? So sometimes what I will do is literally say those things out loud. I will say to an individual,
yes,
I am not sure if you want to be doing this or not. So in case you don't, I'm going to coach your body out of it to see if it's helpful. That's how I'll say, right? I will tell them, I don't know, but I think maybe. And so I'll give you this support and then we'll see what happens.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's one idea. I'm not going to lose another one. I refuse. What you're talking about, it relates, at least from my understanding of it, right? That relates to the basal ganglia, which is an area that keeps coming up. Because if there are signaling issues or volume differences, structural or functional differences in the basal ganglia, we're seeing a reduced ability or an inability to initiate or terminate these voluntary movements in certain behavioral contexts, or this inability to suppress involuntary movements, maybe differences in velocity or amount of movement, different muscle tones. So all of these things we're describing, it could be related to, in part, brains are not that simple, in part to the basal ganglia differences. So down to like the structural level. But you just reminded me of, because like when I first heard people talking about like talk to maybe like the loop, you know, kind of like in other forms of like psychotherapy, it's like talk back to your thoughts. But I heard people saying like, talk to them about the loop. And I'm like, this kid is 5 or 6. Like, they might not even know they have a brain, like anatomically, right? I'm just trying to think, like, what do they understand about their body and brain? But then I tried it. It was really cool to see how talking to the motor loop and what that child was experiencing, it's almost like it gave her an option to move out of it. It was
an off ramp. Yeah, an off ramp. Here's your off ramp if you want it. That's what it is.
Right. It was like acknowledging it. And then I turned it into a song and she like stopped and looked at me. And then we were able to move on to something else because I could tell she was distressed by it. But yeah. If she's having a great time, she could have just continued. So
I think the most important piece of that too is acknowledging that I don't think this is intentional, right? When we approach it like this is behavior and it's intentional, it can be so distressing to already be doing something you don't want to be doing. And then to then, you know, potentially be, you know, fear rejection or some sort of consequence for doing something you don't want to be doing. It's just like, it's trauma on trauma, right? But when we look at it and go, I don't know if this is something you want to be doing. So I'm going to coach your body and give you that off ramp in case you want to like move on from this. It's really partnering with them. It's much more of a collaborative approach to supporting the individual.
And like, I've been starting to just embrace being vulnerable and not knowing out loud with the kid. So I have a couple people who ask, like, what did you say to that child? What do you mean by kind of like talking through it or talking to it? With this kid, I noticed I'd set up an obstacle course because I was like, motor, I'm going to kill it with this, like all this movement. But she got stuck in the obstacle course and started getting really stressed. And just, I could see she started heavy breathing when she's stressed. And so I just kind of said out loud, because I was thinking out loud to me too and to her. And I was like, it seems like you're not having a good time with this anymore. I wonder if your body feels a little bit caught in the obstacle course. And so then I just started singing. Let me think back to what the song is. Doesn't really matter. I can just make up a new right now. But if my body's in a loop, I can jump off, like jump off the obstacle. If my body's in a loop, I can walk off. My body's in a loop. I think that's what I did. But I was giving her body these other verbs that she could do instead. I can jump off. I can walk off. Instead of just whatever her body got into kind of that loop was, here's another option that your legs can take. So I think that's similar to what I did.
Yeah. And I know the question was like, how do you talk a kid out of a motor loop? But the only example that's like immediately popping into my head is maybe just another example of like motor coaching the body and how it can work really beautifully. So it's not specific to loops, but I think it's still like, you know, really illustrative.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What it can look like and how it can look and how you can make your best guess about like, I think that you're not your body's. Yeah. Yeah. So let me just do the example. I have a sensory swing outside my office. It's this beautiful, large sensory swing. And it's like really high up in the trees. So it gets this really long swing. It's like so fun. Everybody loves it. People are like obsessed with this swing, myself included. And I had this same 7-year-old kid that I talked about earlier who liked to go on hikes, you know, wanted to go on the swing. His body was giving all the indications of wanting to go to the swing. And he's kind of like walking up to it. And then walking away and then like walking up to it really intensely and then walking away. And like a couple times was able to like almost back his butt down, but then like couldn't carry it through. Right. And I think there was a bit of fear there, maybe even fear of like, I don't really trust my body. Like, am I going to just fall through the thing and fall through the ground? You know, am I going to injure, you know, he just couldn't really trust his body to do it. And so, and I'd given it all these like, you know, supports and scaffolds, and I was like holding the swing so it wouldn't move at all. It definitely wasn't going to like fly out from under him. And he still kept like back, you know, inching down, then getting up, inching down and then walking away. And it was like getting vocalizing in a way that told me he was getting distressed. So I finally just like, I took my tone down and I coached him step by step. You're going to back your legs up to the swing. You're going to feel the back of the swing touch your legs. You're going to lower your bottom slowly onto the swing. You're going to feel it touch your bottom. You're going to lean back and grab the ropes. Then you're on the swing. And as I like just calmly coached him through each step of that, he sat down into the swing and then was just like this like relief washed over him. Like, oh my God, I did it. Like he just like couldn't get his body to do the thing. And I think there was like this anxiety involved with it too. And I really think when we're talking about complex bodies, we are also talking about a lot of anxiety, a lot.
Oh, yeah.
That's a huge piece of it too.
I like that. Yeah, breaking it down to all of the levels that we might take for granted when it comes to movement. And if there's all of those little tiny steps to accomplishing something, and you've never done that sequence of movements before, how anxiety inducing. You don't know how it's going to go. You can't predict the future of how it's going to feel. But then you have someone who you already hopefully trust, who is letting you know what the future is probably going to be like. And then the next moment is probably going to be like, and now I can predict, I can predict, I can predict, and I feel a little bit safer. And then here I am.
Yep.
Okay, we're going to stop it right there. Perfect.
There's so much we didn't get to talk about, but that was still a really good conversation.
I looked at the time and I got literally so mad. So I'd love to have you back. I think just based on, my gosh, guys, thank you so much for all of your participation. Clearly from all of this, we need to do this again. There's so many questions. It also gives me more time to learn more and do more research. Thanks, Cynthia, wishing this convo was longer. But guys, we do have to hop off. Jesse, thank you so much. We are definitely going to have you back.
Well, I'm always happy to come back and chat more about this. I love this topic and thank you guys for attending and being so involved. I love all the
engagement. This was top notch. Thank you everybody so much. Hope to see you back at the Gestalt Get Together soon. Good night.
Remember to visit speechtherapypd.com to earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode and to see our library of over 1,400 courses for all things SLP.